The secretly negotiated Trans-Pacific Partnership will help companies litigate and could make drugs expensive. But after some last-minute changes, won't we all be better off? Probably not. My name's Justin MacArthur. This is Three Word Slogan. Episode 1. Smoke-free, smog-free. Earlier this week, a bunch of countries got together in Atlanta, home of the Braves, and agreed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, the biggest trade deal in more than 20 years. It's rather fitting that the TPP was agreed to overnight, at least for those of us in Australia. The deal has been negotiated largely in secret since 2008, and so the bulk of the information we've known about it has come from the ever-reliable and ever-morally questionable WikiLeaks, as well as dribs and drabs from the various trade ministers negotiating the deal. It remains largely secret, even though it's just been agreed to. It won't be officially available until it's been signed properly in a few months, though we'll get to see the full text of it sooner when it has to pass the United States Congress. Until that time, we're relying on the information released over the past few days to tell us the clauses it contains and what those clauses will mean for the citizens of different countries, both those that have agreed to it and those that haven't. Dun dun dun! There are plenty of really helpful articles that have come out over the past couple of days explaining the context of the deal itself, and I'll recap some of the important details here, but my main focus is going to be on explaining what trade deals do in general, and why the Trans-Pacific Partnership is more significant as a really big trade deal than it could ever be because of its individual clauses, the clauses that those various, nonetheless informative articles are talking about. I think these kinds of nuanced discussions about history and political theory and junk are really lacking from Australian political journalism, and that's why I think this is a great topic to open up my new podcast, but I'm getting sidetracked. First up, we need some deets. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has been called an expansion of a much smaller 2006 trade deal between Brunei, Chile, Singapore, and New Zealand. But this is a bit misleading. The extra eight members mean that the new agreement is no longer a small treaty between four small economies, but in fact a very big and powerful Pacific-wide deal, with the addition of Australia, Canada, the United States, Japan, Vietnam, Malaysia, Mexico, and Peru, the partnership has been extended from less than 1% of the world economy to over 40%. For the administration of United States President Barack Obama, the Trans-Pacific Partnership marks a major diplomatic success, sitting neatly alongside America's proposed Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with the European Union. With any luck, the US hoped that they'll get two deals for the price of one. The TPP also helps America give a big middle finger to China. The Wall Street Journal notes that earlier this year, Obama was clearly framing the deal as a way of setting American-style rules, rather than Chinese-style rules, for the, quote, road of business, unquote. Even if China signed onto the deal later, as Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe would like, they'll have to play by the rules set by the United States. But one of the major concerns with the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that American rules aren't always ideal, and especially when it comes to healthcare. In the US, companies with patents on so-called biologics, medicines with biological components, including vaccines, drugs, and gene therapies, are allowed to hold data about the manufacture of their medicines for up to 12 years, giving the companies an effective monopoly on their production. The argument for this policy goes that if companies know their research is going to be undercut in just a few months because another company can make cheaper copies of their product, then they have little incentive to find new medicines. Now, this is one of the components of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that has been made public. In the TPP, a term of only 5 to 8 years has been agreed upon, following intense pressure on the United States from Canada, New Zealand, and Australia in particular. But 5 to 8 years is still a long time for only a single company to have exclusive rights to medical data, since such monopolies also drive up the prices of drugs that are medically necessary. As the Sydney Morning Herald puts it, it'll mean that drug companies can set prices as high as the market will bear. And as the Canadian Globe and Mail observes, this is a major concern for publicly funded healthcare systems, because if the price of drugs goes up, they'll either have to cut services, reallocate public funds, or raise taxes. Medicine Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders for those that don't speak French, are also concerned about patent protection in the long term, because they rely on the cheaper generic drugs, threatened by these clauses, to fight disease in developing countries. The Public Health Association of Australia have identified Vietnam and Peru, both countries that are future signatories to the deal, as particularly threatened. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has claimed that the cost of medicines will not go up in Australia under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that may be correct for a number of reasons. Chief among them, a leaked document on WikiLeaks shows that, at least at one stage, there was a proposal for a number of Australian medical regulation bodies to be exempted from this part of the trade deal. But I'm actually hoping this isn't the reason Turnbull is so confident. It'd be quite callous, I think, for Australia to be on board with this part of the deal, on the proviso that we personally were not harmed, even though all the while, the deal continues to threaten international aid. Press in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand have all expressed reservations about this part of the deal in particular. But the Australian media have primarily been focused on the impact the deal will have on the Australian sugar industry, who hoped that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would allow them to sell more sugar to the United States. The US will allow Australia to sell them another 65,000 tons of sugar each year, bringing the total quota to just over 150,000 tons, one-fifth of the 750,000 tons that the CEO of the Australian Sugar Milling Council, Dominic Nolan, was pushing for back in July. The US have argued that quotas are necessary to protect their domestic industry against an influx of too much sugar, but this perhaps rings a little false from the country that puts sugar in bread, cheese, and tomato sauce. To my mind, the most promising part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the series of legally enforceable workforce rules promised to be contained in the deal, which will force Vietnam and Malaysia, in particular, to establish independent unions, improve workplace conditions, and deter human trafficking. The Obama administration has also suggested that the deal contains enforceable rules around environmental behaviours, a rare victory for a free trade deal with the potential to bring about real economic penalties for environmental misconduct. Both of these sets of rules would presumably be enforceable through the World Trade Organization, but again, we haven't seen them, so we can't know for sure. Barely mentioned in most reporting, however, is the component of the partnership devoted to investor-state dispute settlement, which, and I reckon this is incredibly exciting, has specific clauses written to exclude tobacco companies from investor-state dispute settlement. To explain exactly why I'm excited by this part of the deal, I'm going to have to get to the heart of why we signed trade deals in the first place. And on the flip side, this discussion will also help me in explaining why the Australian government is currently being sued by four countries and a massive cigarette manufacturer over our anti-tobacco laws, under a treaty that was never even ratified by the Australian Parliament. But to do that, we'll need to unpack more about Australian tobacco, about the way we sign treaties, and about free trade in general. Australia has been a world leader in the fight against tobacco. Tobacco advertising was banned in Australia in 1992. Restrictions on the packaging of cigarettes have been increasing since around that time, and since 2007, most public places are completely smoke-free. All this has meant that in the last 20 years, the number of Australians smoking daily has almost halved, from around a quarter to around an eighth. Perhaps the fight against tobacco culminated in Australia in 2011 under Prime Minister Julia Gillard and Health Minister Nicola Roxon, when our nation's world first plain packaging laws stopped tobacco companies from printing any of their own images, colours, or text on cigarette packets themselves, save a brand name, which must itself meet strict guidelines. The lid of each packet has an anti-smoking message in big, bold letters, and the body is covered with a vulgar image of a diseased body part. The name of the brand and product only gets to sit in small letters under this big, ugly image and on a background of olive green, chosen to remind people of the colour of tar, although the colour is technically called drab dark brown, not olive green, after the Australian Olive Association complained about the name. So on one packet, the small white words Benson & Hedges Fine sit on a tar brown background beneath a picture of a rotten, gangrenous foot, and the large, bolded white words Smoking causes peripheral vascular disease. On another, Winfield Blue is adorned lovingly with the sentiment, smoking harms unborn babies, above a picture of a wrinkled infant struggling to breathe, clinging to a respirator. These laws are some of the strongest market-based anti-tobacco laws ever implemented. But sometimes countries really love trade, and if you love something, you're supposed to set it free. Tobacco companies have been up in arms about plain packaging since its inception, because the law restricts their capacity to trade in cigarettes in Australia. In 2012, cigarette manufacturers Philip Morris, Japan Tobacco, British American Tobacco, and Imperial Tobacco ambitiously tried to argue that the Australian government wasn't actually allowed to pass plain packaging laws in the first place because it wasn't one of the jobs given to the government under the Australian Constitution. The High Court dismissed that claim, but two major ones remain. Under previous free trade agreements signed off on by the Australian government, and if they succeed, the government will have to repeal plain packaging. The worst part is, these cases aren't just an unfortunate byproduct of free trade deals. They're actually the reason we sign them at all. You see, in a free trade agreement, one country goes to another and says, hey, "You seem dandy. We should trade with one another. Why don't you make it easier for our companies to sell things to your people, and in return, we'll make it easier for your companies to sell things to our people?" The way that countries make it easier to trade internationally is by removing various rules that restrict the actions of companies and the movement of traded goods. Some of these rules are just monetary, import taxes, called tariffs, while others are limits on what goods can be imported and the manner in which goods arrive, things like the way that goods have to be labelled, the ingredients they can and can't contain, and so forth. This is why free trade, or as it's sometimes called, trade liberalisation, is supported by companies. It allows them to find new groups of people or markets to sell their goods to, without having to worry about meeting a lot of different rules in a lot of different countries. Politically, someone that believes this kind of liberalisation is usually or always good is known as a neoliberal. And neoliberalism has had a big impact on the way world leaders see their roles and the roles of their countries. Free trade agreements became a key part of international cooperations about halfway through last century, after the end of the Second World War, when countries around the world were seeking new ways to secure partnerships with one another. Up until the Second World War, empires, most notably the British, had been built on stealing things from other nations and guarding the way they were traded. So after the war saw many of those empires fall, freeing trade sounded like the revolution worth having. It started humbly enough. In 1947, a bunch of countries, led by the United States, established the fun-sounding General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, after failing to create an organization that they were then planning to call the International Trade Organization. For many years after the GATT was agreed upon, the countries that signed up acted as a sort of de facto trade monitoring group, threatening to sanction countries violating trade deals, and in general creating trade deals started to become a trendy thing to do economically. They worked to mutual advantage and they still allowed companies to play favourites and be a bit cliquey. The GATT discussions also gave a bit more legitimacy to the fledgling European Economic Community, which led to the European Union. And meanwhile, under Nikita Khrushchev's leadership of the Soviet Union, Russia moved towards free trade and away from Stalinist isolation, often referred to as Khrushchev's attempt to thaw out the Cold War. In this change, American economics, being worldly and integrated, was seen to triumph over Russia's intense isolationist nationalism, which culminated in the fall of the USSR in 1991. Similarly, in 1980s Australia, the Bob Hawke and Paul Keating Labor governments saw the most sweeping and significant economic reforms since Australia became a country at the turn of the 20th century. Under Prime Ministers Hawke and Keating, isolating import tax and employee-focused minimum wage laws were dismantled in favour of freer trade, and wage laws focused more on the ability of employers to pay. Though there are a number of other factors that can be held responsible, the years since these reforms were the strongest years in Australia's economic history. So when the World Trade Organization was founded in 1994, nearly 50 years after the International Trade Organization failed to catch on, its principles were worded to incorporate the same ideological passion for the free movement of money and goods that opened up Europe and changed the political face of much of the globe. And Australia were right on board with it. Among the benefits that the World Trade Organization listed on their own website are providing greater choice, protecting governments from the lobbying of narrow interest groups, cutting the cost of living, and promoting peace. The World Trade Organization's website also contains a list of 10 flaws of the organization, or as they've put it, misunderstandings. But the link to that page returns a 404 page not found error, so I've had to provide some flaws of my own. Problems arise with the WTO when those meddling rules that interfere with choice and increase living costs existed to serve social or environmental aims, rather than purely economic goals. You see, under a free trade deal like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if a country feels that lawmakers in another country have unfairly hurt trade, then they can choose to settle the dispute by suing the other country in the dispute settlement body of the World Trade Organization. So the governments of Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Honduras, and Indonesia are currently suing Australia over plain packaging after Ukraine pulled out last year. In total, 41 nations have weighed in on the case being fought out in the WTO. Recently, a number of free trade deals have also contained clauses that allow companies to sue countries if a company feels unfairly targeted. These are those investor state dispute settlement clauses that I was so excited about at the start of this podcast. Because one of these clauses existed in a 1993 free trade agreement between Australia and Hong Kong, the Australian government is currently being sued directly by Philip Morris, who claim that our laws have unfairly damaged their business. This is being fought out in the United Nations. Philip Morris can sue Australia because allegedly our plain packaging laws constitute an attack on their ability to do business, discriminating against the packages they use internationally, which are branded, and therefore unfairly harming the company, who after all were just trying to make an honest buck plying death sticks to suggestible addicts. So far, Australia has spent $50 million defending the case, which will be fought in two parts. First, Philip Morris Asia will have to prove that they were actually negatively influenced at all by the Australian laws, since Australia's government are arguing they bought Philip Morris Australia Limited in early 2011, in full knowledge that the Australian Parliament were planning to pass the laws later that year. Therefore, Philip Morris would have no right to cry foul. But if the cigarette manufacturer can successfully claim harm, then the case will become about whether Australia's laws have unfairly restricted trade under the Free Trade Agreement, whether Australia can defend the laws as a reasonable and comprehensive public health measure rather than an attack on specific companies. The plain packaging scheme makes us world leaders. Ireland and the United Kingdom both passed plain packaging laws earlier this year, which will come through next year, and France and New Zealand are halfway through passing similar laws, both countries having passed the legislation through one of their two houses of parliament. But it could be torn down here without any formal approval from the Australian Parliament, a problem that's unique to the free trade deals we sign. Under the Constitution of Australia, the power to sign treaties is an executive power, held by the Prime Minister's government, not the broader parliament of lots of parties from which the government is formed. This means that usually, international treaties signed by the Prime Minister don't bind us to a course of action domestically, unless the Parliament pass a law that says the same thing as the treaty. But once they've been signed, free trade deals have consequences for non-compliance, and these take effect regardless of whether the deal has been passed into a law by the Australian Parliament. In 1996, Prime Minister John Howard passed laws forcing international treaties to a committee, which decides whether each treaty ought to be supported by the Australian Parliament and ratified for domestic law. And that committee has referred almost every treaty to the Parliament for ratification, which hopefully guards us a bit against Prime Ministers using their executive powers to sign just any old thing. But the Prime Minister still could sign a treaty without parliamentary ratification, and we'd all be bound by it, because of the sanctions that could be imposed on us internationally. And the treaty we're actually being sued under by Philip Morris, the Hong Kong-Australia Agreement from 1993, predates the introduction of these laws by Howard, meaning there's no sense in which the Australian people ever assented to it. That's probably not the scariest power held by the Prime Minister alone, which is the capacity to take our country to war without asking anyone, but it's pretty iffy nonetheless, and it means we've left a lot riding on the cases being fought currently in the United Nations and the World Trade Organization. Similar cases have been lost by other countries in the past, and frankly it would suck to lose a law as effective as plain packaging over a treaty our Parliament haven't even approved. I ought to reiterate at this point that the changes made to the Trans-Pacific Partnership specifically preclude tobacco companies from suing us over our plain packaging laws. This is the bit that I was so excited about at the start of this podcast. It's a really important change to the TPP. If those changes hadn't been negotiated, we'd be even more screwed. And it definitely is a change, too. Obama only announced that this would be a part of the deal last week, after 2 years of strong lobbying for our Minister of Trade, Andrew Robb. At one point, Andrew Robb even wrote a letter to Melbourne newspaper The Age, specifically expressing just how firm he was about not backing down on plain packaging. It's good diplomacy that has brought about these caveats in the deal, and that's worth acknowledging. Critics of the deal haven't really been mentioning the positive work that's been done by the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and that's a real shame. But as I mentioned before, similar cases, not based around tobacco, have been lost by other countries in the past, so we still have a bit to fear from the partnership even with these caveats in place. Take the solar panels case from Ontario, Canada as an example. By 2009, Canada had long had difficulties reducing its national emissions, owing, like Australia, to a dwindling focus on making stuff in favour of mining stuff, which led to a high Canadian dollar following an extensive resources boom. So the government of Ontario, the most populous state in Canada, decided to incentivize countries to make solar panels locally, with the intention of taking the entire state off of coal power by 2014. The companies were encouraged to make their solar panels in Ontario using what's called a feed-in tariff program, which guaranteed that once solar panels were put in place, the companies would be repaid by being able to sell power back to the grid, ensuring long-term economic benefits for those companies ballsy enough to take it on. In exchange, a minimum percentage of their workforce and materials had to come from Ontario. Put simply, the program worked. In 3 years, Ontario was the largest solar producer in Canada. In 4 years, they had only one coal-fired power plant left in the whole state. And by the start of its 5th year, Ontario's solar power program had created 31,000 local jobs. And then Japan and the European Union sued the government of Canada because the local content requirements for the workforce and materials were allegedly a violation of international free trade law, discriminating against international exporters of materials in the process of protecting local enterprise. The World Trade Organization ruled against Canada, and the government of Ontario backed down and removed the local content rules that had been integral to revitalizing local manufacturing through the program. Consequently, international backers pulled out, and now some of the solar power manufacturers in the state are threatening to close. Certainly, no new manufacturers have set up shop since the WTO decision. In both the Australian plain packaging case and the Canadian solar panel case, we can see that trade law is not just an important step away from isolationism. Sometimes it's also a tool used by companies and governments to revoke laws that cause them personal economic harm, despite the demonstrable social and environmental benefits of these laws. We're so often told that freeing trade and removing regulations will lead us to some sort of capitalist utopia, a Randian wet dream where markets reward entrepreneurialism, risk-taking, and innovation. But if freeing trade means missing out on the economic solutions to some of the greatest crises of our time, economic solutions that are themselves being proposed by corporate pioneers, then we can see that freeing trade comes at a cost. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has accused skeptics of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as well as of the China Free Trade Agreement, of trying to send Australia back to the economic models that seemed to isolate us prior to the liberalising reforms of Prime Ministers Hawke and Keating. And perhaps it would be unwise at this point to go back to blanket economic protectionism, putting thousands of tariffs back in place to give ourselves a temporary economic boost, but simultaneously becoming internationally isolated. And we can see that some of the fear-mongering prior to the agreement about the danger of further investor-state dispute settlement clauses that would open us to more legal action from tobacco companies was misled. But there's a significant difference between blanket protectionism and intervening in particular industries to promote social and environmental goals, goals that will not automatically be righted by the everyday man-on-the-street consumer. Smoking and climate change are both good examples. For the most part, teenagers are idiots. And if we don't give them plenty of reasons not to smoke, some of them will probably smoke. And for the most part, people don't think much about where their power comes from. So making solar power a convenient economic choice is important if we actually want people to choose it. These sorts of rational economic moves become less practicable under the average free trade deal. Hopefully, the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership will turn out to be less scary than the shadowy, secretive ghost that's lingering in the back of the mind of every Australian political writer right now. But it's quite possible that it'll suck, and maybe even for reasons we don't know about. And it's all tied to the bizarre economic priorities that bring about deals like this in the first place, putting the rights of companies and money ahead of the rights of countries and their citizens. We need to pay attention to the contents of deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, signed without any need for the consent of the people of our nation, and often completely without our knowledge. Say what you like about big companies, but right now they're paying attention, and most people aren't.